TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports,
baby!
All the time. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, we're going to take you with Triple Chop. We're going to bring you up to speed.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this afternoon at TSN1290.ca, good afternoon, universe. And welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues, Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Michael Remus is on loan to us from Rick Ralph and the Rona Roundtable for this Saturday afternoon. 3 hours of hockey talk coming at you here on TSN 1290. Joining us in the final hour from the Dallas Morning News is Mike Hajka. He's going to join us to discuss the hiring of Jim Neal as the new Dallas Stars head coach, general manager. 2:30, live from Saskatoon, where the Memorial Cup will be decided tomorrow, Sunaya Sapurji, the junior hockey columnist from Yahoo Canada, is going to join us. Between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock, we're going to spend the hour talking about Brian Little and the contract analysis that Richard Pollock did for Brian Little on IllegalCurve.com. Spend an hour talking about Brian Little, how we see those negotiations playing out. But between now and the top of the next hour, we're going to focus our attention on the NHL playoffs. Let's start last night in Pittsburgh, where the Pittsburgh Penguins defeated the Ottawa Senators 6-2, and as a result, they won the series 4-1. I'll start with this question to you both, Richie and Ezzy. Are you surprised at how easily the Pittsburgh Penguins handled the Ottawa Senators, given each team's first-round results?
A little bit, but I was a little bit surprised that the Islanders were able to take the Penguins to 6 games. And I know that people have maybe thought that the Eastern Conference semifinals thus far have been maybe not as good as it could have been based on how the first round went with the Ottawa-Montreal storylines and the surprising New York Islanders. But, Richie, the Pittsburgh Penguins are a well-oiled machine. They picked up a couple of players. You could even throw in Douglas Murray in there. But they picked up Brendan Morrow and Jerome McGinley, two guys that are hungry for their first-ever Stanley Cup. And this is a team that has one thing in mind, and that's winning the Stanley Cup. I'm a little bit surprised in the sense that the Senators have been absolutely shellacked the last 2 games. Combined score of 13-4 or whatever it is. But they're an overtime goal away from sweeping the Senators. And when the Pittsburgh Penguins are hot, and there was a lot talked about how they hadn't really hit their stride in that Islanders series, and they hadn't even hit their stride early on in this series, and now they've hit their stride. They're scoring on the power play. They're checking the Ottawa Senators. And I'm not surprised that this series ended in 5 games. I thought it would be 4 or 5 games. And good on the Ottawa Senators for getting this far. Mm-hmm. I didn't even think the Ottawa Senators were going to make the playoffs at the beginning of the year. But good for them for beating the Montreal Canadiens. But the Pittsburgh Penguins now are just one series away from getting to the Stanley Cup Finals. And I think they are unquestionably the favorite right now, because I think they're finally hitting their stride. I think that third game really woke them up. I really do think that Game 3 loss in Ottawa really woke them up. And now they're playing the way we thought they were going to play in that first round.
Yeah, I agree. And I think when you look at Pittsburgh and their success, guys, I mean, Ottawa succeeded against Montreal by, you know, playing against a smaller team. And I think Pittsburgh, on the other hand, has the skill, more skill than Montreal. But not only that, they have the size. So they have James Neal, and they have Jerome McGinley, and they have Brendan Morrow. And Malkin's not a small guy. Crosby's certainly willing to mix it up. And, you know, that's not even getting into their third line and such. So that mix of skill, we didn't get to make our predictions. And size was too much for the Senators to combat. I was surprised at the way, you know, I thought Pittsburgh would win the series. I think everybody probably did, although a few may have picked an upset based on Ottawa's performance in the first round and Pittsburgh's performance in the first round. But overall, Ottawa's team defense wasn't as good as it really has been all year. And that was their downfall. I mean, they were getting beat in one-on-one situations. Obviously, Eric Karlsson came back too early, we've realized. and hasn't hit his stride skating wise, and we'll have to take the summer obviously to do that. But even Jared Cowan, remember game one, his turnovers, and overall they just looked like a group that you know. And one other thing to note, guys, is that group as a whole, with Spezza back, and again a lot of these guys came back and they're not 100%, but also think about the fact that those guys all played together really for the first time all year. And so it kind of was a different group at the end than it was down the stretch. Not that it wasn't more talented, because it certainly was, but more talent doesn't necessarily mean more success.
There's something to be said for chemistry, and the Senators, you know, when you spend, you know, the first 5 or 10 games of the regular season building chemistry, it's a lot easier than when you're trying to build that chemistry, you know, in the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. And it just looked like they were a step slower than the Penguins. They just didn't have, like you mentioned, Carlson obviously came back, and he wasn't the same Erik Karlsson that, you know, we see, you know, when he's at full 100%. Jared Cowan, same sort of thing. And Spezza is also the same thing. It just takes time to get back into the flow of the game.
Ottawa did a really good job in round one of using their big defensemen and keeping Montreal at the outside. And they were unable to do that here. I mean, you saw the numerous plays where people going to the net. And Pittsburgh has players who were not only unafraid to go to the net, but unafraid to go to the net and have the skill to capitalize on it. And Anderson really had to be otherworldly for this team to beat Pittsburgh, regardless of, you know, if you were picking Ottawa to win the series, that was on the assumption that Anderson would play as he basically had all year. And the problem statistically is that he doesn't play against Pittsburgh all year.
Right. That's a good point. You know, after this, I mean, 4-1 win for Pittsburgh, pretty easy. Mm-hmm. Are they the clear-cut favorite to win the Stanley Cup based on today, right now, in this vacuum?
I really think they are. And I thought that they were the second-best team. I picked Chicago to win the Cup, and I picked Chicago to play Pittsburgh in the Cup Finals. But as we know, Chicago's down 3-1 to the Detroit Red Wings, and that series is continuing tonight. We're going to talk about that later. But right now, I think Pittsburgh, to me, has taken a step above Chicago. And it's not just because Chicago was down 3-1. I think Pittsburgh, really, in the last two games, has really shown us what you need to do to win the Stanley Cup. And it's not just coming from a few players. James Neal and Jerome McGinley, the first three games, I think, had a combined 1 or 2 points. And now they've really taken over the series. Sidney Crosby had the hat trick in game two. And Malkin's been good. Kunitz has been good. Dupuis's been good throughout the whole playoffs. Those guys have been really good. That line has really eaten up Carlson and Mark Methot really throughout the whole series, maybe with the exception of game three. But they're so deep top to bottom. They really are so deep top to bottom. And Brooks Orpik now is getting a little bit more comfortable. He's getting back into that shutdown role. Thomas Vokoun has been unbelievable. His save percentage is just incredible. And it really shows you how good they can be when they're healthy. They're essentially healthy right now. Chris Letang has 16 points, which is incredible. He's really taken over the series offensively, not so much defensively, but offensively. But right now, I mean, where's a weakness on the Pittsburgh Penguins? Find any weakness. The one weakness that we've pointed out, and the one guy I've never really liked on the Penguins and he's not playing, is Englund. They've taken Derek Englund out of the lineup, and Mark Eaton is playing well in that other role, but a guy like Paul Martin has played really well. Their defense is playing really well. I don't see a weakness, really. I think the Bruins will take them probably to 6 or 7 games, but I ultimately think the Penguins can't be beat at this point.
And, you know, I thought the Bruins would be their toughest try. The East is top-heavy, guys. Pittsburgh and Boston were the best teams in the league this year, and they're likely going to be facing each other in the conference finals. But in terms of Pittsburgh, guys, I mean, they've played the second worst team and the worst team in the Eastern Conference playoffs, in all honesty. And so have they really been tested? And I like what the Islanders did to them, skating them, but will Pittsburgh's defense be able, and I think there are questions about their defense, be able to handle Boston beneath the hash marks? That doesn't mean that Boston is easily able to handle Pittsburgh's offense, but from that perspective, have they faced the size and skill combination and the depth combination of a Boston team? No, because they've played the 7th and 8th teams. So we really haven't seen a test yet. You know, they lose to Ottawa that game in Game 3, but they're up 2-0. Is that really a test? The test comes against a team that has won before, is not fearful of you.
The test is, you know, a synonym in this case for adversity.
Right.
Like you're, and I mean, my next question was going to be, who would they rather face, New York or Boston?
Well, I mean, New York, because New York is not going to. I mean, New York is a team in disarray, really, Drew. Mm-hmm. I mean, they won, they beat Boston, but in reality, and we'll talk about the Rangers, I guess, next segment or the segment after. Boston is the team that they don't want to face, because when you look at the middle, this team is deep, and there's some guys who are getting going. Like Sagan just started to get going now. Chara's been playing really well. Rask. I mean, obviously Lundqvist is a great goalie. But overall, top to bottom, Boston is the better team. And they present far more issues for Pittsburgh than does them do the New York Rangers.
Would you say that Boston's forward depth, well, I mean, it's not as talented, I would say, as Pittsburgh's, but their forward depth is probably, you know, 1A versus 1B?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And you have to think about, as far as Pittsburgh's next opponent goes, Pittsburgh wants this series to go to 6 or 7 games, right?
Sure. Like
they want another game. They want these two teams to beat each other up, but they want to face the Rangers. The Bruins are a better team, and it's funny. I did think that the Rangers would pull out one win in that series, and I don't think they're going to be able to do it again because Boston's just too good. They're playing really well right now, and that game could have gone either way. I mean, it went to overtime, right? Anything can happen in overtime, but Pittsburgh would want to play the Rangers, but if this series can go an extra couple days, I think they'll rest and like the fact that they're going to play an opponent that's a little bit more bruised up. But I think Richie's right. I mean, you did face the Islanders, and the series was tied, and it became a best of three, but you really haven't faced a Game 7 situation. And that series between the Bruins and the Penguins, and we're going under the assumption it will be, I think there's a good chance that'll be one of those 7-game classics because you're talking about two teams that really don't have very many weaknesses. Sure, they're the 1-2 seeds, the Bruins are actually the 4th seed, but essentially the two. I always thought these two teams are the best two teams in the East. I know Montreal got the second.
Standings notwithstanding, I mean, you would think that if you had to, you know, jot them down on paper based on talent level, it would be Pittsburgh and then Boston.
They've also demonstrated
that you can, you know, people talk about not being able to turn it on. Well, a lot of players in Boston have turned it on. I don't think that can be debated.
And like you said, too, a guy like Tyler Seguin just popped in his first goal, although he's leading the entire playoffs in shots, but he was getting so many good chances. And they've got so many guys that have played at a high level for so long. Krejci, Horton, Lucic, Marchand, go up Bergeron. You go up and down the list. So talented. And even a guy like Torrey Krug has come in and just done a great job. They have so much depth, it's unbelievable.
Are you comfortable with Pittsburgh's goaltending situation at this point?
Yeah, right now you have to be encouraged by Vokun, but again,
was he tested that much in the Ottawa series?
It's also, you know, Ottawa likes to play kind of a physical game, etc., but do they really have the players and the size and skill combination of Boston? Can Vokun handle, because Vokun looks shaky at times, can Vokun handle Lucic in front of the net? Can Vokun handle Horton? Can Vokun handle a lot of the other, Marchand in his face all the time? It's a different challenge if Boston gets through. So I'm not yet convinced that Vokun is the guy. I mean, he's played well before in the past. He had some playoff issues, but overall statistics over the course of his career have been very solid. But this is not the Ottawa Senators or the Islanders in relief. This would be a fresh series with the Stanley Cup final waiting at the end of that series. And that's a whole different ballgame.
Before we go to break, a quick note from the Hockey Canada meetings that are taking place. Hockey Canada federations have voted in favor of removing body checking from Pee Wee hockey coast to coast in Canada. What this means is 11, 12-year-olds, there'll no longer be any body checking right across Canada for kids of that age. So interesting move there by Hockey Canada, one that I'm sure will be discussed throughout the years. Anyways, let's go to break. When we come back, we'll continue breaking down the NHL playoffs. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. The CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest-growing, and most diverse accounting body in the province. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in Canada, with an average yearly salary of $72,000 for new graduates? For more information, contact the CGA Association of Manitoba at cga-manitoba.org or call them at 204-477-1256. The CGA Association of Manitoba. We see more than numbers. Gentlemen, moving on in our analysis of the second round of the NHL playoffs, we go to Chicago, where Detroit and Chicago will play Game 5 tonight. The Red Wings lead 3-1. Question I have for both of you is that, you know, if you look at these two teams on paper, it's arguable that maybe the two teams have the have an equal top line in their goaltending. Maybe Detroit has a very slight edge, but you know, person by person on the roster, player by player, the Chicago Blackhawks are the more talented team. Why right now are they losing 3-1?
That I'll steal Richie's line. That's a really good question. I think that the Detroit Red Wings are completely frustrating the Chicago Blackhawks. I think they're getting out-coached badly. Mm-hmm. And sure, you look at Jonathan Toews, he doesn't have a goal yet. He has 3 assists so far in the playoffs. And we've all seen the stats. You go back to the year after they won the Stanley Cup, and Jonathan Toews hasn't been as successful as he was, especially the last couple of years. Chicago Blackhawks were knocked out in the first two rounds the first last couple of years. But Jonathan Toews has been completely frustrated. He's been frustrated by Nicholas Cronwall. He's been frustrated by Henrik Zetterberg. But the Detroit Red Wings almost have the Chicago Blackhawks exactly where they want them. They're almost outplaying the Chicago Blackhawks at their own game. Mm-hmm. And you look at their defense, and on paper you're thinking, you know, why shouldn't Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews and Marian Hossa be eating these guys up? Well, Nicholas Cronwall and Jonathan Erickson are playing really good. Jakob Kindle's doing a really good job. They're playing really well, and they're almost outplaying them, and I think they're in their minds at this point. Jonathan Toews last game took 3 minor penalties, and you can just see the frustration on his face. You look at when Brent Seabrook has to come over to him in the bench, and he has to tell him to calm down. Like, this is your captain, and they're really getting frustrated, and they can't score. The big guys aren't scoring. Patrick Kane was almost invisible in Game 4. And we're going to find out in a few hours if the Chicago Blackhawks are going to lay down or they're going to come back in this series. But right now, you're looking for any window of opportunity for the Chicago Blackhawks to come back right now. But the Detroit Red Wings are just on you at all times. And sure, Richie, puck possession is a big part of it. The Detroit Red Wings have had the puck more. But, I mean, the Chicago Blackhawks really are having trouble getting everything going. The four lines that they were rolling out are not getting the job done. And it's not just one or two guys. Toews and Hossa really haven't been getting the job done. And it doesn't seem like anybody else is stepping up in their place. It was Patrick Sharp in the first round. Mm-hmm. Marian Hossa hasn't been there. And it's really incredible because, you know, I didn't even think the Detroit Red Wings were going to get out of the first round. And now it looks like they could almost get back to the Stanley Cup Finals again this year, the way they're playing.
Yeah, Mike Babcock has just done such a tremendous job here. Just the way he handles everything. And I mean by that is he handles the young players, which we're going to get into in a second, the way he handles the media, the way he's prepared, the way he sees the game and feels the game. He's at a different level, guys. I mean, this guy's at a different level. And obviously the credit goes to the players. But even, you know, this week, I see Mike Babcock, or hear Mike Babcock on radio interviews and Ken Holland doing radio interviews. They're not fazed. They don't shut down. They like the spotlight. They enjoy it. They talk about it. They're not fazed by it. They don't have media speak. They're honest. I mean, as honest as coaches can be and general managers can be. They give you their opinion. What I get from that is a confidence. It's a confidence in themselves and in the process of what they do day to day. Babcock has his team. After game one, I want to talk about Babcock for a little bit here. Because after game one, he could have gone on his team. What's the usual coach reaction after a game like that? Tortorella would be going off, this, we don't do that, for the most part. Although he didn't do that for Game 3 in the Rangers series. Babcock says, we're tired. We've been traveling a lot. We're going to go home. We're going to have a couple days off. We'll be better Game 2. But we're tired. We have a tired group. And some would say you're making excuses for the team. But he just called it as he saw it. And that's exactly what it was. They were a tired group. They came out in Game 2. Great game. And the patience is so important because not only is he coaching right now to within one game of the conference finals on a team that some thought wouldn't even make the playoffs, but he's developing talent while doing so. Do you know how hard that is? You know how many coaches defer to the older players at the end of the day? And Claude Julien's doing it. He's a good coach, but he's doing it with Jagr and such. And you look at, and he's had to, obviously on the back end with the injuries, he's had to rely on the young guys, but only with injuries.
Rich, you know what I love that Babcock's done with this team? During the lockout, Damian Brunner played with Henrik Zetterberg, and we didn't know a lot about him. Unless you watched, mm-hmm. Unless you watched YouTube videos of Swiss League action, you wouldn't really know that much about him, except for the fact that he put up really good numbers, mm-hmm. And then that he had played with Zetterberg. But earlier on in the season, and what's also impressive, Richie, you know, you talk about, you know, Babcock's composure and Holland's patience with the roster and all that. He even admitted that early on in the season they weren't even really finding their stride, and it wasn't until really the three-quarter mark of the season when they really found their stride. Remember, the Wings were in danger of missing the playoffs at certain points in the season, but what I love is they've put this line together of Gustav Nyquist, Joachim Andersen, and Brunner. Andersen being a guy they called up from Grand Rapids, who wasn't really a huge part of the roster, but now that roster, they haven't really led the team offensively, but it's a skill line that when they're on the ice, they have the puck, and they cause some problems for Chicago's third pairing. I think Michael Roosevelt, and I know, Richie, you don't really like him. No. I think he's been awful for the Chicago Blackhawks.
I don't like him at all.
He's been slow, and they've taken advantage of him. But just the way he's changed the lines. Justin Abdelkader, a guy who has been on the Red Wings for 3 or 4 years, has had limited success on the fourth line, but now they put him on the top line. And sure, he's nowhere near as good as a guy like Zetterberg or Datsyuk, but he's a fast guy, and he doesn't look out of place. Now they've kind of turned him into a bit of a forechecker, a guy that can cause some problems in the sense of a two-way game. So he's really kind of mixed and matched his lines, and for all you want to say about the Detroit Red Wings going into the playoffs, right now they look like a much better team than the Chicago Blackhawks. And
is the operative word there.
Yeah, and it proves that, you know, you can have Taves, you can have Hossa, you can have all these guys, but in a series, when you're playing each team, when you're playing each other night in and night out, I mean, it's. I don't think anybody expected a guy like Jonathan Taves to have no points going into Game 5 of the second round for the Chicago Blackhawks. You didn't expect it to happen.
Let me ask you guys this question. Obviously, we saw Jonathan Taves in Game 4. He took those three minor penalties in a five-minute span.
Yep.
Was that a captain trying to get his team going, or was that a captain who lost control and was frustrated?
Yeah, more lost control and frustrated. I think that he's frustrated with his team, and he's frustrated with himself. I think those go hand in hand, because he thinks if he would be playing better, the team would have a better results. And, you know, we talk about team was the operative word mentioned before, but what about adversity? I mean, have the Hawks had any?
This year, no.
And conversely, have the Red Wings had any? In fact, they've had a lot.
They've had to battle just to make. They had to battle just to get this far into the playoffs. They have to battle to make the playoffs. They have to win a game 7 on the road in round 1.
And didn't they win 3 games in overtime in that series?
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about a team that was counted out numerous times, and steadying hands of Mike Babcock. I thought Joel Quenneville's lost his composure a little bit too. And you look at a team like Chicago, Drew. It's a highly skilled squad, but one that's kind of one-dimensional skill-wise. I mean, they're not like Pittsburgh that way. They're more skate-create offense than Pittsburgh's ability to kind of muck it up a little bit more.
There was a lot of chatter that because Chicago hasn't been able to gain any speed through the neutral zone, Detroit's been doing a very good job at preventing Chicago from entering the Detroit zone with speed. That's really been a factor in the first 4 games of the series.
Well, look at the defensemen they have, though. We talked about Jakob Kindle, but Brendan Smith, who got a very important goal. You look at their defensemen, all big guys, all mobile guys.
All mobile, yeah.
Carlo Koliakovo, I think he might have been injured towards the end of that game, but these aren't all one defenseman. Cronwall is probably the only one defenseman they have, and then you basically have a bunch of, you know, really good defensive defensemen with limited offensive skill. And these guys have been around for a while. Erickson's not in his first year, and neither is Koliakovo by any stretch of the imagination, but they're playing really well as a unit. You know what I really like, too, just quickly, Richie, about the Detroit Red Wings? They're rolling 4 lines, too.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that last line of Emberton, Eaves, and Drew Miller. They roll those guys out there. They're good defensive players, good penalty killers. They're rolling 4 lines, and they just look like a team that's in control. They look like they have a better game plan. And I think if there's a lasting image for me of the first 4 games of the series, it's Henrik Zetterberg going at Jonathan Taves. Jonathan Taves just being completely frustrated. Mm-hmm. You know, there was an image of Zetterberg holding Taves' stick and kind of just smiling at him and saying, like, okay, you know, whose series is this here? And really, you know, the reason why it's so important in the playoffs, your best players have to be your best players. It's not just on the score sheet. It's really how they're leading by example. And I really think that Zetterberg and Datsyuk have the Red Wings playing a much better game, and Taves and Kane are kind of almost, they look like almost kids that are kind of frustrated because they're used to scoring goals, and they're slapping their sticks on the ice because they can't score.
You know, Jimmy Howard, we haven't mentioned, has been incredible. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we have to mention that. He's been great. Another guy the Red Wings have entrusted for the long haul with his recent contract extension. But as you mentioned, Cronwall has been incredible. He's been great.
Yep.
Been everything they imagined and more. Lidstrom he's really taken that spot, and he's really emerged as that guy this year. But Jonathan Erickson, a guy who people don't realize, a lot of people don't realize, played forward when he was drafted. It's been a long process. But again, Brendan Smith, a really offensively talented guy, he on most teams would play right away. And he doesn't do that in Detroit. So would Kindle. So would Nyquist. So would Anderson. And they don't do that. So they have seasoning. And they come in and they've paid the price to get to that level. Now, it doesn't mean that we're completely discounting Chicago. Chicago is two of the next three games, if there are two or three games at home.
Mm-hmm.
And you get on the score sheet and you get some confidence and you certainly have the talent to do it. But their best players have to be their best players. Like Anaheim, you know, Anaheim didn't win because Corey Perry couldn't score.
Right.
And that was probably the main reason they lost. And to Chicago, does Jonathan Toews want to be that same guy?
Because if Toews doesn't score, you'll point to that as one of the reasons that Chicago lost. Let me ask you guys this question, and we're right up against it. What's happened with Brent Seabrook? Only 12 minutes in Game 4.
There are some rumors that he's injured. And the game before that, I believe his minutes were at 7 or 8 minutes. He hasn't played poorly, but a guy like Brent Seabrook, they've actually changed the pairings. He used to always play with Duncan Keith.
Mm-hmm.
He'll play with Duncan Keith on the power play, but what they've done is they've changed it up now. And to me, I think he has to be injured. I can't see any other explanation for that, because a guy like Brent Seabrook has typically played 20 to 23 minutes a game. So that's the rumor. Nothing's come about of that, but that's really what they're talking about. And Duncan Keith has been phenomenal. In this series, he's been great. In the last series, he was great. He's good offensively, both sides of the puck. But Seabrook is a guy, too, that you have to kind of wonder, if he was at his full capacity, how different would this series be? Because he can be a dominant player as well.
Yeah, and skating, though, you know, he's not a terrible skater by any means, but skating is not his strength, I'd say. And, you know, he got beat, I think it was on the Gustav Nyquist goal, got beat wide, and he has a tendency to get beat wide. On occasion, so Detroit probably isn't the best matchup for him. And I mean, how many guys aside from Franzen are really going in there and being that aggressive? It's a skating game, and so, you know, if people remember the Olympics, he kind of had trouble with that skating game too. Obviously against better competition, but the problem is that's a little bit of his. He's a really good all around defenseman, guys, but he's not a top end offensive defenseman, and he's not the best skater. Those are a couple of his drawbacks.
One word answer: if the Chicago Blackhawks go out to the Detroit Red Wings, and if they go out in 5 or 6 games, is Joel Quenneville in trouble as the Blackhawks head coach?
Well, I'm not going to give you one. I think he may be, but I do think that Stan Bowman bears just as much, if not more, responsibility for this team. And so I don't think it would be fair to put Joel Quenneville on the firing block at all.
Is he?
I'm going to say no, but I think that something has happened here which has led to a colossal meltdown, and it's you know, somebody has to take some responsibility for it, but I don't think he'll lose his job.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Continuing our review of the NHL playoffs, we move now to Boston and New York. Game 5 later this afternoon, I think 4:30 start time on TSN, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe 3:30. I'll double-check on that one.
3:30 Central, I think.
3:30 Central on TSN, I believe. Boston leads the New York Rangers 3-1. Game 5 tonight, this afternoon, rather, in Boston, where they have a chance to put away the series. Let's start with the coaching decision made by John Tortorella. Do you agree with his decision to bench Brad Richards?
That's a loaded question. You know, Drew, I don't, because of really what they're trying to replace him with and what they're trying to do. I mean, John Tortorella is really, I feel like there's different motive there. You know, I don't feel like it's solely just to win a game, because he was hardly playing Richards anyways.
Even though the reason that Richards chose to sign in New York largely had to do with John Tortorella being behind the bench.
Well, the other angle on that is that Tortorella might be fired after this game if they were to lose Game 4 or lose Game 5, and he's basically saying to the organization, deal with this contract now, kind of thing. So there's I think there are some possible backstories there. I think overall, Drew, Are the Rangers losing because of Brad Richards? That's the question I have. So are you scapegoating? And has he played well? No. Have you put him in positions to play that well? I'm not sure about that.
Explain what you mean about that. Being put it like you, who his line mates are, or the in what he's being asked to do.
I mean, well, a lot of that stuff. And people are talking about the big thing about Richards is they're talking about his foot speed. Let me tell you something. He's never been fast. So I think that's a little bit much. And I think people are overanalyzing that. I mean, he's maybe not as fast as he was, and he wasn't that fast in the first place. But you're not putting him in positions to succeed overall. And sure, he hasn't been good, but other guys haven't been that good. This is not a team. First of all, this is a team that really misses Mark Stahl. But this is not a team that's good enough to beat Boston. So is benching Richards, are you gonna attribute that benching, Ezzy, to the win in Game 4? They very well could have lost Game 4.
I think what we're seeing with the New York Rangers, and again, they went to the Eastern Conference Finals last year, and that has a lot to do with keeping games low-scoring, relying on the goaltending of Henrik Lundqvist, who might win another Vezina trophy. And this year, we're seeing that they don't have enough scoring, and they didn't have enough scoring during the regular season. Rick Nash was disappointing. Brad Richards was disappointing. I mean, this is my take on it. Brad Richards has one goal in 9 or 10 games. He hasn't produced offensively. Now, he's still in the game, and John Tortorella decides, going into Game 4, we might get swept. Brad Richards was on the fourth line. First off, Brad Richards should never be on the fourth line. He shouldn't. He's a former Conn Smythe winner. He shouldn't be on the fourth line. That's not why he was given.
Who they put in for him? Remember?
It wasn't Ashton. I mean,
Chris Newbery.
Yeah, it was Newbery.
Newbery is a career AHLer. I mean, what, that gives you a better chance to win?
So what his mindset is going into that game is, Richards isn't getting it done. I'm going to bench him because Derek Brassard is now my second line center, and Derek Stepan is my first line center. So he doesn't really fit in, and Brian Boyle is my third line center. Brad Richards is a center, obviously. So we're saying, okay, well, he's not going to do anything on the fourth line, so why put him in? Well, the argument that I would make is he should have never been there. Okay, he's got one goal. But you still have, you just have to. When you have a guy in your lineup of the quality of Brad Richards, you just have to keep playing him. And obviously, John Tortorella disagreed with me. But now what do? You won, so you can't put him back in the lineup. And you have to think that if John Tortorella was going to do this, why didn't he do this in the first round?
By the way, I don't buy that argument. I understand where you're coming from, but I don't buy the argument that they can't put him back into the lineup. I mean, you saw how they won that game game 4 against Boston.
I think
Tuukka Rask had to trip and fall over nothing. I mean, it was a fluke win. It's not like that was a good performance by the Rangers.
Here's a quote about it. This is Tortorella. I'm playing Brad on the fourth line. He's playing 7 or 8 minutes, and it's not good for him. It doesn't work playing Brad Richards that way, but I feel some other guys have played better. So basically what he's saying is, I'm putting you on the fourth line because you're not playing well, but the fourth line role is not best for you, so I'm not playing you at all. So essentially he's saying, you're second or first line player or you're nothing. And in my opinion, I don't care how little he's playing on the fourth line, any time he puts in is better than Chris Newbery or Michael Haley.
But guys, let's step away from the series for a second here, though. Think about this. The Rangers end up coming back down 3 games and they win this series. Are they going to beat the Pittsburgh Penguins? Maybe. I would say they won't.
No, because the Rangers are done.
The Rangers will most likely be done. So what is Tortorella doing here? Real strategy? And that's why I agree with what you're saying, Richie, that, okay, you know, is Tortorella a lame duck here? Is he done? Is he asking management to pick between Richards and Tortorella? Like, what is his main goal here? Regardless of what is happening, you're benching Brad Richards at a time when you need a win most. And what you're saying is, I mean, everyone saw this. When Brad Richards was asked about the benching, I mean, it's like you're asking a guy who at one point was one of the most skilled players in the NHL. It's a guy who won a Conn Smythe trophy. Sure, he's 33 years old now, and he's lost a step. He's still Brad Richards. It's not like all of a sudden he's become a bum. I mean, you're still benching Brad Richards. And to me, when I heard that, I almost had to... I almost had to, you know, give my head a shake. I mean, yeah, we all know Brad Richards is struggling, and it's not as if he doesn't think about that every night. He wants to get it going. But of all the guys to bench, and of all the times to bench him, you're benching him in Game 4 of the second round when you need probably his best ever. To me, it's almost Tortorella's feeling to motivate him.
And it also is the way he plays the game. The way he coaches the game, Tortorella. He wants to win these games 2-1. They've been completely outclassed by Boston, by the way. But the puck control has been in Boston's favor. They've controlled the boards. And you have Brad Richards, and he's not playing maybe the style that Tortorella wants to play. And by the way, Tortorella's style has changed completely, or at least very significantly, from the style of play he utilized when he had Richards, Le Calvier, St. Louis, and those guys in Tampa.
When he won a cup with Tampa, you're saying. Right. Let me ask you about the style, because that was my next question that I had to hear is, you know, you look at the Bruins on the back end, on the defense, mm-hmm. they are riddled with injuries. Are you surprised that that the Rangers haven't been able to take advantage of the young, inexperienced defense that Boston's putting out there, and how much of that inability to do so has to do with Tortorella's refusal to change his strategy?
I think a little bit, Drew, but I want to get to that point about you talking about the Boston defense. I think it's forced Claude Julien's hand to play the younger players, and the younger players that they've replaced the veterans with because of injury are actually more talented offensively than the players that were in there in the first place. Krug, Hamilton, those guys can skate and move the puck. Probably better than the guys they replaced. And those guys were probably playing because of age and seniority and experience. But the transition game with Boston may be better with those guys in there right now.
I just, to answer your question, Drew, I think you look at a guy like Torrey Krug, you look at Matt Bartkowski, Dougie mm-hmm. Hamilton, mm-hmm. they've taken Wade Redden out, and Torrey Krug was in the lineup because Andrew Ferentz got injured. He might be ready to come back soon, but those guys have done a great job.
Redden shouldn't be in over any of those guys.
No, he shouldn't, and he had a couple of good games in the first round, but Redden was picked up to be an insurance guy, an insurance seventh defenseman. But Torrey Krug is a guy played for Michigan State. He's done a good job. I think he's got 4 points in four games. He's done a great job. Matt Bartkowski was rumored to be part of that Jerome Iginla trade, if you remember. Uh-huh. He was going to be one of the guys that went back to Calgary. So that tells you what Calgary thought of him, because they wanted to include him in the Iginla trade.
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, that's true. Little shot to Calgary there, but they've done a good job. And, you know, Chara's still out there playing 30 minutes a game.
That's the key.
And Boychuk is just a fantastic defenseman. Richie's always been a fan of Boychuk. And McQuaid's good. You know, he's already got a cup. He's progressed as a defenseman. They're just so solid to beat. And Rask, like you said, Drew, he had a 20-second brain fart, and he let the Rangers back in the series. But this series could have easily been over.
Do you think the series ends tonight?
Yeah,
I do. I thought the Rangers would win one game in New York, but I always thought that the Bruins would win in five or six.
Especially with Boston now seeing Pittsburgh and knowing that they played a 7-game series in round one, and they can limit their travel. I know Boston to New York isn't long, but they limit their travel, limit the wear and tear on the body, and get ready for Pittsburgh. I think they're going to see that carrot dangling right in front of their eyes.
Because they don't want to have to go back to New York for a potential game six, where, I mean, once, you know, the closer the New York gets, obviously, the closer that the tighter the noose gets around Boston.
And more wear and tear and the shot blocking and mm-hmm. the hits. I mean, the Rangers aren't an easy team to play against. You may be able to beat them, but they're not going to, they do hit. Callahan, Boyle's a big guy. They're, you know, their defense, they have some guys who can mix it up a bit. So you want to get out of there as soon as possible.
This isn't based on any inside knowledge, but I do think Tortorella puts Richards back in, though.
We'll find out later on this afternoon. We haven't seen anything about that. There probably wouldn't be
just a gut feeling.
There probably wouldn't be a game day skate with the 3:30 start time, so we probably won't know until just before puck drop.
I think it's a guarantee, because the reason he benches him partially is to get him back going too, I think. Even though they could have been done for the year. So
H to the Izzo, Drew.
Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment of the program is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. I tell you to go see Ryan Hamilton at Rumors tonight. He's already all sold out for this entire weekend, so next opportunity for you is to go see Chad Daniels. He's at Rumors next week. Ari Schaefer, also at Rumors, coming up in June. And then the show with Steve-O from Jackass.
Ari Schaefer.
Different Ari Schaefer than the one you know, Richard.
And my camp counselor?
Yeah, different than that Ari Schaefer. Steve-O from Jackass, August 15th through 17th. All five shows also sold out for Steve-O. So as you can see, Rumors Comedy Club is the place to be.
I'll just rent Jackass on DVD with Remo.
Okay, that sounds like a good plan. A good solid night for the two of you.
Remo, by the way, I was talking to one of my neighbors. He was mentioning that one of his friends used to work for.
Well, you're telling me
A painting company?
I don't talk about this.
I want to hear about it because apparently you were terrible. He said, what, somebody from your show, and I thought, okay, Ezra or Remus. And then he came, Darren, my neighbor, came over the next day and told me it was Remus. Apparently he worked for a day, and that was it.
I don't know. Manual labor isn't my best quality.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Labor in general is not your best quality, I would argue. I
couldn't stay in between the lines, man. I got more of it on my clothes than on the house.
Moving on with the playoffs, the LA Kings and the San Jose Sharks series. Game 6 tomorrow evening in San Jose. The Kings lead the Sharks 3-2. You know, has this been the most evenly matched series of the second round? And if so, are you surprised at that?
Not if you watch Game 5.
Game 5 was the 3-0 blowout by the Kings over the Sharks.
The Kings look dynamite in that game. But yeah, overall, Drew, it's been a pretty evenly matched series. It's been a tough series. It's been good hockey. You know, certainly changes, lead changes, storylines with the bad call and Dustin Penner play. That was an awful call. The refs were terrible in that game. The refs have been pretty bad, actually, throughout the playoffs. But there's certainly been storylines, the California matchup, a lot of skill, size, speed. Yeah, I mean, overall, it's been the best series, I think. I mean, you could debate Detroit-Chicago in terms of pace, but for everything this series involves, it's been pretty evenly matched. But Game 5 was a whole new ballgame. I thought L.A. played their best game of the series in Game 5. They were focused. They were moving the puck well. They played physical. I believe Ray Ferraro mentioned after two periods, San Jose did not have one scoring chance through two periods of Game 5. That's crazy. And Jonathan Quick, obviously, is dynamite. So let's see if San Jose forces a Game 7 here because, I mean, they certainly can. They've played well at home. And L.A. Needs to demonstrate a killer instinct because if they want to go all the way here, you don't want to play these long series.
It seems like L.A. has been, you know, they're playing at, every game they play at a pretty high level. But when they need to step it up, they have another level that no other team in the West has been able to achieve so far this playoffs.
I would agree with that. And as you know, I think the thing about L.A. that would scare me is, you know, Kopitar got a goal last game, got going. But where's Dustin Brown been? I mean, have their best players really been their best players? Justin Williams, have those guys really been that good? They haven't, and they are where they are right now. So if they do get going, the other players continue to contribute, like the Voinovs and such. It's a scary roster.
Yeah, Justin Williams only has 4 points, and he picked up an assist on Kopitar's first goal, Richie, but he's only got 4 points so far, and yeah, Dustin Brown hasn't been very good. I think we have to talk about, and I think everyone knows by now, I favor defensemen because I was a defenseman in my brief hockey career. But Matt Green comes back.
First overall pick in the Jewish Hockey League.
That's right.
Tells you all you need
and
to know.
And I won a championship that year, too.
Weren't you out with a torn ACL that year?
No. That was later on in my floor hockey career. But this isn't about me, Drew. This is about the LA Kings here. But Matt Green comes back, guys, okay? Matt Green was a big part of last year's Stanley Cup winning team. And Matt Green barely played at all this year. Hasn't played at all up until game 4. And hadn't played at all, I don't think, in the regular season. Maybe he played a couple games. Maybe Remo can check that or something. But I don't think he played that much. No, I know he didn't play that much. But he's the type of guy, he's all defense. Just a big guy.
Played 5 regular season
there
games.
There you go. I knew that he didn't play a lot. But he comes back. And now, if you look at the way this defense is constructed, you've got Slava Voyanov and Drew Doughty, who are your offensive guys. And then all your other players are just big, physical defensive defensemen. Robin Regier, Rob Scuderi, Matt Green. It's just, and throw in Jake Muzzin.
Who's a good puck mover. And
Jake Muzzin,
good, shot.
Yeah. Good guy, a guy that I've liked all year. And now this team is almost, they still don't have Willie Mitchell, but they're back to almost a better defense than they were last year. And last year, that was a huge part of it.
Yep.
And you look at what they're doing, and Jonathan Quick had the shutout in Game 1, and then the 3 games in between Game 1 and Game 5 were all one-goal games. But Jonathan Quick has been fantastic again this series, better than he was in the first round. And remember, he wasn't very good in the regular season, but now he's got 2 shutouts in 5 games. The defense, aside from Willie Mitchell, is generally healthy now. Now the LA Kings all of a sudden have hit their stride. And now they're almost a team that is unbeatable. And the San Jose Sharks, they've won the 2 games at home, but I think this series is going to be over in 6, pardon me. I mean 5, sorry, 6.
6. They've already had 5.
Sorry, they've had 5. But right now, it's scary because they were nowhere near the level they were at for most of the regular season. And I didn't even think that they were that great against the Blues, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that's sort of my point, is that they were, you know, at this level, you know, the sort of average level against the Blues for the first four games. And then when they needed to, they just, they said, okay, we want to end it right now. We've, you know, we've been playing, we've sort of been keeping our engines somewhat throttled, and then we're just going to step on it, and we're really going to dominate the next two games, and we're going to end it in six.
You know, good sign. Yeah, you know, you could certainly argue that, Drew. I mean, a good sign. Another good sign for them is Mike Richards, I thought, played a really strong game in Game 5. Getting that line going, Richards, Carter, and Penner is obviously important. But, Drew, I think there is a motivational factor. I think when you're a team that has had success and knows you're capable of success, sometimes it takes a little bit longer to get going. But tonight is going to be interesting, guys, because San Jose didn't have a good performance in Game 5. And let's be honest, San Jose's window. Look at it from San Jose's perspective for a second, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the window's closing. Couture's obviously been terrific. We love him on the show. We've talked about him many times. But the window's closing there, in my opinion. I don't want to speak for everybody here. And they're down 3-2. And they see a Detroit team who they can certainly beat up 3-1 over Chicago, a team that they'd probably have a lot of trouble against, to get to the Stanley Cup Final, the elusive Stanley Cup Final they've never gotten to. They have a home game tonight, and then a Game 7, anything goes. From San Jose and an organizational perspective, you have to try and take a hold of this opportunity because there may not be many more. And history indicates that they will not do that. Maybe it'll be different. But if I was a betting man, I wouldn't be betting on San Jose. They can do it, but they haven't done it in the past.
Has Joe Thornton impressed you at all in these playoffs? Really? 9 points in 9 games? Yeah. Give it Joe Thornton's body of work. Isn't this the best he's ever played in the playoffs?
Yeah, second line center.
I think Joe Thornton was really impressive in the first round against Vancouver. That was really impressive, but really,
great again, passer,
again, you look at that fourth game that LA won 3-0 at home. And, you know, was Joe Thornton a huge part of that game? Not really. I mean, he was an instrumental part in the first round with Logan Couture and Patrick Marleau. I think he's played well. Mm-hmm. And he played better in games 3 and 4, obviously. But, you know, you're facing an LA Kings team here that is essentially the same team as they were last year, and they've just hit their stride now. So, I mean, really, Joe Thornton needs to take his game to the level that it was at last round.
I mean, you know, the question is you have Game 5, right? Game 5, they didn't come out. Patrick Marleau was probably their best player, best forward, at least I'd say. And, you know, where was Thornton in those games? It doesn't mean he hasn't been a solid player. And that's never been the question. But can he take a hold of the opportunity and take his team above and beyond? Don't have to do it every single year. You have to do it 1 year. And even counted on that role anymore. As Couture, you know, usurped him in terms of being that guy. I don't know. But he's still a great passer, sets up Burns, has great vision, all those things. No question about that. But if Joe Thornton wants to be regarded as one of the all-time greats, because his point total will certainly indicate that, he has to take the next step in the playoffs. And this is another opportunity that he has tonight. But if they don't do it, or sorry, is it tomorrow?
Tomorrow evening.
Another opportunity, and if he doesn't take advantage of it, well then, hey, a lot of the same. And people are going to say, oh, he played, I believe, in the World Cup, certainly played in the 2010 Olympics. But let's be real here, guys. He wasn't a core player on either of those teams, a counted on number one player on either of those teams. And a guy with the point totals that he's had ought to be. And it doesn't say anything about his character. He seems like the nicest guy you'll ever meet. Great with the media. Teammates love him. Had a great career thus far. But to be held in the same regard as the best players of all time, you have to take the next step.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to spend the next hour talking about Brian Little and his RFA status with the Winnipeg Jets. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Does Rick let you play this music on the Rona Roundtable?
I might have played this once before.
Yeah, once and then banned, and then it was subsequently banned.
I think Rick's girlfriend liked this one, actually. She tweeted at me.
Anyways, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Disco Hour.
Remus, you know that Drew only likes Neil Diamond.
You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. For the next hour, we're going to be talking about Brian Little. He's a restricted free agent for the Winnipeg Jets this year. Earlier this week, it was Winnipeg Jets contract week on LegalCurve.com.
Drew, why are you dressed as John Travolta?
Saturday Night Fever just happened to, you know, it was, you know, Saturday Afternoon Fever where we're here with you guys. Anyways, Brian Little was the first of the restricted free agents that we talked about on LegalCurve.com. You can read that article in its entirety. We'll tweet it out right now on our Twitter feed, at IllegalCurve. Talked about, you know, the options that the Jets have with Brian Little, you know, what he's probably going to seek in terms of salary and contract years, what we think that Kevin Cheveldayoff should offer, you know, to counter what Brian Little and his representatives are gonna ask for. Really an in-depth look at Brian Little. Let's start with this question. Is Brian Little a top-line NHL centerman? He has been one for the Jets. He's been playing that role for the Jets for the past couple of seasons, playing between Andrew Ladd and Blake Wheeler. Is he a legitimate top-line NHL centerman? Richie, I'll start with you.
I don't think so, Drew. I actually wrote an article about that, I think about 6 months ago. Maybe Remus can find that one, too, and tweet it out. But I don't think he is. And, I mean, you know, in a simplistic way, but I think it is a pretty good indicator of quality. You know, what is his career high in terms of points in a season? It's 51. Can you be an NHL center, a number one NHL center, having never exceeded 51 points in a season? And in that simple view, I don't think you can. I don't think overall he is a first-line center in the NHL, and I think there's also a distinction to be made. Are we talking about, I mean, do you want to win a championship? If you want to win a championship, you need to be strong up the middle. So give me a second here before I let Izzy get in. Let's look, and I've talked about this with somebody off the air. Let's look at the playoffs right now. Pittsburgh's top two centers, I think Crosby and Malkin, have heard of those two guys, right?
Yeah.
And then
okay.
Okay. And Ottawa, you have Spezza, Turris. Okay. Boston, Krejci, Bergeron. Rangers, well, usually Richards and Brassard, whoever it would be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stepan, sorry, excuse me. So it'd be the three there. Good players. All good players. I mean, obviously the Richards issue, but LA, Richards, Kopitar. San Jose, with Couture, Thornton. Other guys can play center there too. Pavelski, of course, and Marleau can play center. And then Chicago, excuse me. Taves, and then you look at the question of, you know, are they playing Sharp or Kane in the middle, or even Boland? Okay, Detroit. You know, who are they playing? Phil Pula, Zetterberg, Datsyuk both play center. So the idea is, those are the top two centers on all those teams. The question I have for you guys, or and for our listeners, and they can tweet at us, is: would you take Brian Little over any of those guys?
And I think it's a good question. And, you know, you mentioned this before, Richie. We talked about this a few months ago during the regular season. I like Brian Little's game. And for the Winnipeg Jets, he is a perfect line mate. And we saw how good the Brian Little, Andrew Ladd, Blake Wheeler line was this year. It was a bona fide number one line. At least for the Jets, it was definitely better than the first year. I think they played as a whole better, and Andrew Ladd really took a step forward. That's why he was the MVP of this team. Apologies to Andre Pavlik, but Andrew Ladd, night in and night out, he really put his team on the back. And many nights, you know, he was responsible for getting this team into the playoff race. But, you know, Brian Little going forward, they are going to have to replace him. And that's something that, you know, and we're not talking about just next year. Going forward for the Winnipeg Jets, they're going to have to find kind of a franchise number one center. Like many teams end up finding, I mean, it's Henrik Sedin in Vancouver, it's Anje Kopitar in L.A. I mean, you got to find that guy and build your franchise around that guy. The center ice position is the most important position. Now, Brian Little is not a number one center. For the Jets, he is, but on most teams, he isn't. And it's not just production, too, as well. Brian Little's a smaller guy, and I don't think he can handle the minutes and all that. Having said that, I do like him, and I think the Jets should re-sign him, and I think they will re-sign him. But going forward, a couple of years from now, if Brian Little is still your number one center, you have to ask yourself, well, are the Jets going to be good enough to get into the playoffs? because they're going to have to definitely improve on the right wing position. After Blake Wheeler, there's a huge gap. They're strong on left wing with Kane and Ladd, but right wing after Wheeler, you've got a lot of holes to fill there on every line, really. So, sure, maybe next year you don't pick up anybody, and you've got Brian Little on the number one line, Olli Jokinen on the second line, maybe Mark Scheifele on that third line, or maybe you decide to play Scheifele as a winger on the second line, but a couple of years from now, that's something that's going to be addressed. I don't think Sheveldayoff will address that this summer, but I think maybe next summer he's going to have to go out and spend money and get a number one line center.
It seems like the consensus in this room is that while Brian Little may have played a first line center role for the Winnipeg Jets the past two seasons, he's not on a good NHL team. On a playoff-bound, with Stanley Cup aspiration NHL team, he's not a number one line center.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Drew. I think the question really is you know, where does he fit in the second line center?
Is he
on
a
really good team?
That was my question. On a good team, on a good playoff team, that wants to make a deep run into the playoffs, because that's everybody's goal, is to make a deep run into the playoffs, at the very least. Is he a number two line center?
He can be. Do I think he compares to some of those top teams and what they have there?
Well,
probably
take
not.
The second-line centers you just rattled off of the last eight.
Generally not, but, I mean, it depends on who you have. You know, are you having Kane and Sharp on your second-line wings? Then, yeah, okay, it's fine. But if are you building up through the middle and that's where your strength's going to be, then maybe not. I mean, you look at the teams that are going to really make the conference finals in Boston. Bergeron and Krejci is not as good as those guys. Obviously, Crosby and Malkin know. If either L.A. or San Jose, both of their second-line centers are better than Little. And then you look at Detroit, depending on what they do, you know, who's playing where. And then Chicago, you could argue because of the lack of center depth in Chicago, which is an issue, I think. Overall, though, it's a valid argument. That's what that article I wrote talks about. You know, is he a second-line center? And I have him as a lower-half second-line center. It doesn't mean we don't respect his game. And I think everybody in this room, you know, respects what he can bring to the table. But you have a guy who's played against tougher competition. We'll talk about that in a bit. And he's played about 20 minutes a game, or just under 20 minutes a game. But not a guy who's been that great of a point producer. And at the end of the day, you need to produce points, guys. I just don't think he's at that level. Now, he's still going to get paid. He'll still get a reasonable salary. But you can't pay him like a number one guy, in my opinion.
Well, we'll get to the actual, you know, contract, the contract we think he's going to sign, and we'll get to that a little bit later in this hour. What are the pros to Brian Little's game? Give me the pros to his game, and then give me the cons to his game.
He's a good skater. He's got a pretty good wrist shot, pretty good release. I think his passing skills are a little bit overrated. Some disagree with that. I think they're a little bit overrated. I like my centers to be really good puck distributors.
In the article, you said he's more of a goal scorer than he is a puck distributor.
That's as I classify him. I wouldn't say he doesn't pass the puck, because he does for sure. But I just think that in terms of his strength, I'm picking one over the other. I'm probably picking his goal scoring ability. And this year didn't indicate that necessarily, but I think over the course of his career, that has been, I think, proof's in the pudding, really. And I do think that they may eventually look to put him as a winger and make him a little more of a shooter. Because at center, it's, you know, they want him to be a little more of a passer. So, I mean, that depends on other guys they have in the system and faceoffs and blah, blah, blah. But overall, I mean, he doesn't have the best finish. That's the problem. He's a shooter, doesn't have the best finish. Not the greatest passer. Not that big. And getting in and around the net and being that aggressive guy. He's not that big and he's not that physical. So you don't have to be big to be physical. And he's not really that big or physical. So He has his drawbacks. He's a solid player. He's got skill. But he's nothing special.
Richie, when you talk about Brian Little, what I like, and I think they do have a decision to make, because as Richie points out in this article, which you should all check out, you should check all of the articles out. There's one about Wheeler and one about Bogosian, because Chevy's got some work to do here with these contracts. Little's probably the easiest one, and I think Richie mentioned that Wheeler might be the hardest one. But when you're talking about Brian Little, if you're going to pay him $4 to $4.5 million a year and you're going to sign him to 4 years, I think that's good as a second-line center, as I think we're trying to harp on here. Because right now, you're essentially paying Olli Jokinen $4.5 million a year to be your number two center. And I think we'd all agree that he's not doing a very good job and he's not earning his money. No offense to Olli Jokinen.
Understatement of the century.
His numbers were horrible this year. And even though he was a nice guy and stuck around in Winnipeg with his family, at the end of the day, it's what have you done for me lately in the NHL.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think Brian Little can, for the next 4 years, fill that role. And I think ideally you don't want Andrew Ladd to be your number one left winger. And it doesn't matter what label you put on it. It's how much minutes you're going to play, what role you're expecting, because this is Evander Kane's team going forward. I mean, he's your number one left winger. So you got to find a center to play with Evander Kane. That will become your top line. Maybe Blake Wheeler stays on that top line. But I think Ladd and Little are guys that, going forward again, 2 or 3 years from now, when Trouba's a little older, when Shifley's a little older, you want that to be your nucleus. You don't want those guys to still be your number one line because they don't produce enough as a number one line to be given that label.
Looking at him in terms of the quality of competition, you know, he plays against the team's best competition. He was second on the team in terms of the quality of competition he would face on a night-in, night-out basis.
And that's based on our friend Gabe Desjardins calculates, you know, I'm not going to get that detailed into it, but the quality of the other team's players that he's playing against is usually the best players.
Right. So if he was to end up in a second line role for the Jets,
yeah,
would you see his numbers improving, or are his points per game average, which has been .63 over the last 3 years, is that about where it's going to be for the entirety of his career, in your opinion?
Well, it depends on minutes played. If you go to second line, you play less minutes, you play less power play time, your numbers probably go down, but probably still respectable.
So has he peaked, you know, points-wise on a points-per-game basis? Is this as best as you're going to get from him?
I mean, Drew, you look at his career and the past. The Thrashers, 2010-11, he had 48 points in 76 games. First year with the Jets, 74 games, 46 points. Essentially the same. And then this past year, 48 games and 32 points. Obviously, 48 games, a hard season to kind of gauge. But you're looking at a guy who's in the 45-point range. Is that a number one center, guys? Again, I don't mean to necessarily have a simplistic view, and I don't think if you read the article, it is a simplistic view. But if you want to take one kind of sign, well, that's probably it, guys.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the comparables, the contract comparables for Brian Little. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to TSN 1290. Programming note for you Gold Eyes fans. Gold Eyes off to a great start this year in the American Association. The game tonight has been changed from a 7 p.m. start time to a 7:45 p.m. first pitch. Around the Association with Paul Edmund, 6 p.m. tonight on TSN 1290. An extended pregame show gets underway at 7, and then first pitch. I believe they're in Lincoln to play the Salt Dogs. The Gold Eyes hope to continue their winning ways. First pitch, 7:45 p.m. tonight with Paul Edmonds here on TSN 1290.
You used to drive a Lincoln, didn't you, Drew?
No. Don't you drive a Lincoln? Didn't you?
In your 60s, you used to drive a Lincoln.
No, you drive... What did you used to have? Your old car. What was it? An Oldsmobile or something?
Oh, the Olds, yeah.
Yeah, the Olds. that thing was a relic.
I love that one.
Yeah. Anyways, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're talking about Brian Little and his contract. He's a restricted free agent right now, and eventually the Jets will likely have to engage in contract negotiations with him. Richie, you wrote this article. Who are the four players you came up with that you thought were Brian Little comparables, and why did you pick those four players?
I wanted to pick players, Drew, that were similar to Little in output, somewhat in style, but more so in the role that they play. Because when you're looking at comparable contracts, you know, who signed contracts recently, and you can't just pick a defenseman or even a winger, really, to me, to compare him to. And so what we've done here is we picked four players who are predominantly center. Alex Steen is one of them. He plays wing as well. But Alex Steen, St. Louis Blues, David Desharnais from the Montreal Canadiens, Mike Fisher from the Nashville Predators, and Franz Nielsen from the New York Islanders. These players play, for the most part, similar minutes to Brian Little against similar competition, again, for the most part. I've had fairly similar output. And if you look at Desharnais is, behind Plekanec, a second-line center. I think Plekanec is a better player than Little. So a second-line center. He's more of a passer than a shooter, but the idea is that, you know, point production-wise, it's been pretty solid. Alex Steen, kind of an underrated player, plays trusted by Ken Hitchcock, relied on, plays similar amount of minutes as Brian Little. Some similar output based on points per game. Plays against pretty tough competition. Mike Fisher, more of a defensive guy, and Little's very respectable defensively.
Yeah.
Fisher, a right-handed shooting guy, you know, kind of topped out offensively, but has points is similar, I think, to Little, and plays against really tough competition. And then Franz Nielsen, guy who plays behind John Tavares, but a two-way center, can dish it, can play on the power play, and has produced very similar totals over the past couple seasons to Brian Little. In fact, those players were 3 points apart this past year. 1 point apart the year before that, and 4 points apart the year before that. So
you're talking about Little and Franz Nielsen in terms of the points they accumulate.
And Nielsen's played against maybe not as good competition, but he also hasn't played as many minutes. So very similar, I think, in terms of overall statistics.
And then you look at their contract status, and Desjardins signed a contract last year. Mm-hmm. He signed, I believe it was a 2-year deal worth $7 million. Is that right? So he's getting $3.5 million per season.
He is getting, I have to actually look at that, what the term is on that.
Well, it looks like it was a 2-year term.
And we'll check into that. We must check into that. Alex Steen, let's put it this way. The players, Desjardins, Steen, Fisher, and Nielsen, will average it out, Ezzy. They average out for their cap hits, that's what's most important, to $3.46 million per year. And when you look at Brian Little, I quickly want to explain to the listeners who don't know, and most people probably do and some don't, in terms of Brian Little's contract situation. Brian Little's coming off a 3-year deal. His entry-level deal was 3 years. Under the CBA, if you accrue seven seasons in the National Hockey League, you become an unrestricted free agent, so anybody can bid on you. Little's 1 year away from that. This year he has salary arbitration rights, meaning the Jets have to qualify him. They have to provide him with a qualifying offer equal to what he made last year. So long as they qualify him, they retain his rights. He will reject the offer, almost assuredly, but they will qualify him and retain his rights, and then what will happen is he'll have the option of electing for salary arbitration later on, wherein he can get a 1-year deal with the Jets and then get to unrestricted free agency the next year.
And there's nothing to believe that Brian Little is only going to want a 1-year contract. He's only played with one franchise, mm-hmm. started his career with the Thrashers, and all accounts are that he likes playing in Winnipeg, and you know he had a good year last year, this past year, I should say, and you'd have to think that for the Jets, that would be the worst possible thing that could happen. Then he basically just walks into unrestricted free agency,
exactly.
And that's why you had him at either a 3 or 4 year deal.
And also, Drew, I want to quickly get into, you know, the age when they signed the contracts.
Sure.
Those players overall were about 29 years old, so older than Little on average. But Desjardins was 26, and the other guys were a little bit older. But I think overall, when you look at all the numbers, I think these are fairly, I would hope, fairly good comparables for Brian Little in a contract negotiation.
Yeah, the only guy who was significantly older is Mike Fisher. He's 32 when he signed his most recent contract. And, I mean, he's got sort of family ties that are also very much keeping him in Nashville, given, you know, he's married to Carrie Underwood and her career aspirations, you know, right. Sort of make him a perfect fit for that Nashville team. But, you know, you look at, you know, so if these guys, if Desjardins and Steen and Fisher and Nielsen are averaging $3.46 million a year for 3 years, so about just under a $12 million contract, about $11.5 million over 3 years. Why isn't it as simple as the Jets just plugging that number in and getting a deal done with Brian Little?
Well, he has one RFA year left, which would be a little bit of a discount year for the Jets, but he would be a UFA after that, and you know that's an inflated. Once you're in the free agent market, the numbers are inflated. I think Little, for the most part, appears to have indicated he wants to be here in Winnipeg, and the Jets don't have any alternatives in the middle right now. And
let's talk about the lack of
Jokinen, and they have Scheifele and such, and Burmistrov, but who knows what's going on with Burmistrov. We'll talk about that later on.
Slater.
Our colleague Gary Laws said that he likely wants out of town. Jim Slater's a fourth-line center at best, I think. Jokinen, and he can't, you know, he has to be better than last year, but who knows anyways. And Scheifele is still a young player. You're going to suddenly plug a young player like that into a top-line role against Zdeno Chara every night? I think that'd be ridiculous. So you kind of need Little right now.
And how much leverage does that give to Brian Little and his representatives?
It gives him leverage, but let's also be real here. He's not Sidney Crosby. So the Jets aren't going to be bent over backwards just to be able to have Little in the fold. I think they both need each other, frankly. And I think that's when you get to the term. Brian Little is a guy who is not going to get a 6-7-8 year deal. He's not good enough. Let's be frank. But a 1 or 2 year deal for both sides, he wants more security than that. And the Jets probably want more term than that, is he? So I think that's where you got to get into the landing spot of 3 or 4 or 5 year deal. And I think 4 is probably the most reasonable of those.
4 would take him to the time that he's about 30 years old, where you would expect, you know, usually you hope that a guy's skill set is going to hold out at least until he's 30. Now, granted, he's a little bit undersized, but he doesn't play an especially physical game.
Right.
So, you know, if the Jets were to get 4 years out of Brian Little, they would hope that he'd be in and around where he has been point per game-wise the last 3 years, around the 0.7 mark, 0.6 mark for the last number of years. So, I mean, a four-year deal just seems like you're getting a guy who's, you know, in his prime, but when his prime really isn't overwhelmingly significant.
And I think when you're talking about a 1 or 2 year deal, I think that's dangerous because then he's heading into unrestricted free agency and you're not getting anything for him. So I think it's in each side's best interest to go for a 3 or 4 year deal.
You look at that then. You look at the 4 years or however many years they end up signing him for. And, you know, it's sort of hard. I mean, are you paying him as a first-line player or are you paying him as a second-line player?
I think you have to pay him based on the comparables and overall production. I don't think you pay him based upon the exact situation he has and, you know, the exact situation he's in with your franchise. You know, if you don't have a number one defenseman, you don't pay your number one defenseman National Hockey League money. That's foolish.
You mentioned it before, too. Next year, barring something unforeseen, he will be the number one center, and he will play with Andrew Ladd and Blake Wheeler. I mean, next year, Mark Scheifele will play for the Jets. It's clear. He's not. Maybe he'll start the season in the AHL, or he'll spend some significant time playing for St. John's, but he'll be in the NHL. And like you said, he won't be a first-line center next year, unless he warrants it. But at this point, he's too young to be a number one line center, maybe even a second-line center. So Brian Little will be the number one line center maybe for 2 more years. Mm-hmm. It's possible. Maybe it's just one, but it's possible it's 2 more years. So I think you are paying him as a guy who has the skill of a second-line center, but a guy that's also been your number one line center and will probably be the number one line center for 2 more years.
And that's what I want to talk about in terms of after the break, Drew.
Okay.
In terms of getting him locked into a number that's reasonable for his role now and reasonable for what you hope to be his role later.
Let's leave it there. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.